also do you remember me also of mail art? It was something.
Oh, and right, where people are mail. Yeah, there's a guy I know who does this too. Like always, like, you know, mailing, like making these handmade things and then sending them through the mail. And there's somebody who had a project that was something about postcard art, and they would solicit people to send them postcards.
But it's something kind of fluxus.
Yeah.
Period.
Yeah.
Or even when or they like were exchanging the tape.
Almost like a, yeah, like a tape, like a William Burroughs kind of exquisite corpse type thing.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah,
something.
The surrealist. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Are you influenced by this as well somehow? This particular.
For this particular piece, I maybe hadn't thought of that in specifically, but I think a lot of that kind of stuff does flow into my consciousness when I'm making work, and so probably in an unconscious way. But but yeah, so I'm having fun with it. I want to do a really theatrical staging. And actually, you can see, if you search, I didn't even know this until recently, because one of the members of this chorus I'm working with found it and told me about it. But there's a YouTube from Wesleyan, where they had interviewed me, and then they also shot video of the performance. And so it's just a short video, but it has me talking about the piece, and then it also shows a few little video excerpts from the live performance with these students playing the typewriters and singing and so on in their theater there. So if you wanted to see a little bit of that, you might
of
be able
course.
To find it.
I would like to go into the direction of the technology.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously it's part of,
yeah.
of your work.
Mm-hmm.
So how did you start? I mean, because going from lyrical, even rock, and all your background,
yeah.
but
mm-hmm.
what was the relationship with sensor? I mean, today maybe is something that, I mean, I don't know if people really work with the Kinect or this sensor, whatever. But what was the trigger?
Well, the very first thing that happened was I was still living in Boulder, Colorado. I hadn't moved to San Francisco yet. And I had gotten out of music school, and I was doing radio. I had a radio program called the Tuesday Afternoon Sound Alternative, and it was on a local public radio station. And I was playing just sort of freeform radio, all different kinds of music, and I was mixing it up and playing. Everything was sort of a little bit experimental that I was choosing, but from many genres. So it would go from, you know, avant-garde, like it would go from like Stockhausen to the Ramones or you know, the Sex Pistols, and then the Roaches, and then Varese, and then
Bad Brains, maybe.
Yeah, something like that. And it was all mixed together in one show, and I would jump around from like these sort of experimental and contemporary classical composers to like punk rock to all these different things. And I began to realize that my taste in music and what was interesting to me, and Brian Eno and like this Philip Glass knee plays and things like that, that I was much more interested in experimental music and the music that I was at that point. I was actually playing music for a living. I was playing in clubs and in sort of as a singer-songwriter, you know. And I realized at this point that the music that I was actually performing had no relationship with or didn't sound hardly anything at all like the music that I was actually listening to and playing on my radio show. And so I thought, I really want to do something that will bring my music into a more experimental, adventurous way, you know? So I just kept trying different things, and everything kept coming out sounding really the same or maybe contrived and not, and I just couldn't find it. I couldn't find what it was that I was looking for. And then one day I saw someone do a solo on the bass. And this is, we're talking maybe 1982 or 83, probably 82, but in the early 80s. And it was Jaco Pastorius, the bassist from Weather Report, and these guys all walked off the stage and left Jaco alone on the stage, and he started playing this bass solo, and all of a sudden he's looping his bass and doing all this, improvising on the top of that. And I said, what is happening here? Because now everybody does looping, but in those days, no one was doing it. And I had never seen anything like that. And I said, oh my God. And I went to a music store and I said, this guy had this thing, and it was like, he played, and then he said, oh, that's a digital delay. And I said, I'll take one, please. And then he said, no, you don't really want what he had, because he probably had a guitar stomp box. And those, at that time, memory was so expensive that those little stomp boxes, even though they had long delay, like kind of like 8 seconds or something, the sampling rate was incredibly low. So he said, this is going to sound terrible on your voice. You want something with a higher sampling rate so that the recording quality will be good. So I bought a rack mountable digital delay. It was made by Ibanez. And it had a very short delay, because memory was so expensive that if you had high sampling rate, you had to have short time. And so I took it home, I started playing with it, and honestly, that was the point where my life just completely changed. And I feel like that was actually when I found my voice as an artist, because I started listening very differently. I started composing completely differently. I started thinking about patterns and repetition and texture and timbre and all of those things being as important as melody and harmony and rhythm, you know. And finding also things like when you make a sample of something, of speech, and repeats, then you begin to hear that, oh, there's all these melodic material that's embedded in the speech, and rhythmic material. And so I just started listening completely differently, and I started composing completely differently. And that was sort of the moment. And so moving forward from there, I bought many more digital delays, and over the next few years, memory prices went down and down on memory, so eventually I was able to have much longer delays. I had a whole rack full of them, and I had them all patched together in like a big old Mackie mixer on top, and was running my voice through them and returning it to the mixer, and just making a whole kind of music that was just based on layers of my voice capturing them in real time. And I figured out how to do like out of phase loops and all, you know, setting the delays at different lengths, and you know, that was the beginning. And then about 10 years after that, or not quite, another thing happened, which was that I met these guys who had this instrument called the body synth, which was kind of a terrible name for the instrument, because it wasn't really a synthesizer, it was a MIDI controller, but they thought that the word synth sounded cool, so they called it the body synth.
The
one guy's name was Ed Severinghouse, and the other guy's name was Chris Van Ralty. And Ed was they're in San Francisco. This okay. is I had as soon as I forgot to say this, but as soon as I started working with digital delays, like within a year, I moved to San Francisco.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And so then while I was living there and developing my work, I met up with these guys, and I got one of their instruments, and it was it's this gesture control instrument that involves electrode sensors. Like, this is medical equipment, so it's like
ECG.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like they put them on people's brains, or like if you see somebody in the hospital, they sometimes put it here to measure like the heart.
For the ECG,
you know?
EMG.
Yeah, exactly.
EMG,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So it's those electrodes. And so it's exactly those ones. It's not like a version of them. It's the exact ones that they buy them from a medical supplier. And then they had this little CPU that they programmed that takes the signal from these electrodes and turns it into numbers, which can then be interpreted as MIDI information. And so I got one of those instruments and I started using it. And for many, many years, the body synth was my gesture controller. And so that was my entree into using sensors. and for performance so that I could use gestures to control the sound. And I used it for many years, and then at some point I started migrating to these other controllers that I use now. So yeah.
Okay. We can say that technology shaped a bit the music you wanted to do somewhere.
Yeah.
I mean, although one can say that piano is is technology as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
But in this sense, it just like...
We got the toll of the bell. I'll use this as an opportunity to take a bite of my cake.
Okay, good. That's just for me, it's good sound.
That's beautiful. And there's two, and they're out of phase.
Do you think they're electronic?
Hard to say. When I was in music school in Colorado, University of Colorado Boulder, they had a bell tower, and they had replaced the bells with like a tape of bells, and it was so old that every time the bells were about to toll, first you'd hear. This big tape hiss just broadcast over the whole campus. Ding, ding. It's ridiculous.
Well, it's okay. I don't mind the bells.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is the last question.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? What do you think about machine learning, artificial intelligence, or artificial stupidity? Or no, maybe this
artificial is artificial stupidity. I like that.
Maybe this is real stupidity. Actually, it's not artificial. but I mean.
These are the AI and AS.
But I mean, the technology we were mentioning—it was something quite radical. I mean, for Jaco, for you, for many people. I mean, it was something that really brought an aesthetic, a genre, whatever. It was a big shift, I guess.
Yeah.
Being the delays or the sensors. But now we kind of, I don't know if it's a crossroad, that's why I'm a bit sarcastic, because everybody is like the new thing for everything, everything is intelligent and so on, but what's your view on this? I mean,
it's definitely a double-edged sword, and also I think it's sometimes, I think people are overthinking it sometimes, like that they feel like they need to figure out a way to get computers to do and be in charge of everything. And I don't know that that's necessary. I mean, I think some things are better left to the humans, you know? But I don't have any hard and fast rules about it. I think it's a case-by-case situation. But for example, self-driving cars. Like, what is going on with that? I mean, I think maybe, you know, we laugh now, maybe 20 years from now, people will say, ha ha, they didn't think this was, and pretty, you know, maybe there won't be anybody driving their own car anymore, and I don't know. But at this point, I'm just trying to imagine, like, I'm thinking about how easy it is for people to hack. Like, already there's cases of, because now even the cars that are still not self-driving, but they're all like everything's a computer in it now, and they've got like the cruise control, where the computer is making a decision about like, okay, you're going to go 55 miles an hour, you don't have to do anything, you can take your foot off the gas, the car will do it, and that's great. But there have been cases already where people have hacked into that. And so somebody's like driving, and then all of a sudden they can't control their car because it's been, the computer in their car has been hacked. So now I'm thinking, whoa, what if you have self-driving cars somebody has to program it as to what it's supposed to do or not supposed to do. And then are you going to have like hacking wars with the cars and people are going to... Or like, you know, just people do scrambling it. Like, I saw these two guys on YouTube, and I don't remember what the... I'm trying to remember what the site was, but the idea was that they had figured out a code that, like, you know those codes that you can scan them? So they'd figured out a code that would confuse the facial recognition, like Google's or Facebook's facial recognition.
Okay.
And so one guy is, they're standing side by side, and you know how the computer will put the little square around some, it sees a face and goes, oh, here's a face. Do you want to tag this person? So this square was finding one guy's face. The other guy's holding this card in front of his chest. He's not even covering his face with it. He's just holding it in the image. And as long as it was near him, facial recognition thing was broken. Like, it could not find him because he was holding this code, which was basically somebody had hacked something to confuse the facial recognition thing. And so there, he's holding it. His friend is standing next to him. Thing is, square is finding him right away. He hands the card to the friend. And immediately, the little face thing on the guy's goes, oh, here's a person. And it just went over here.
Okay.
And it was like, it couldn't find a person if that person was holding this card. And I thought, whoa. So there must be some kind of technology with the self-driving cars that is designed to, the car can recognize that somebody has walked out in front of the car and will stop. So is there some way that that could get jammed or broken so that the car does not notice that somebody walks out in front of it and then it just hits the person, you know? I don't know. There's just so many weird little scary bits about things where the computers are the artificial intelligences are taking over jobs now that kind of require some pretty sophisticated decision making.
Mm.
And so that seems a little scary to me, like just the idea of the self-driving cars being, if there's just, right now there's like 5 or 6 of them, you know, you're on the road and it's mostly regular cars and there's a few of those. But what about when it's the other way around? What about when 95% of the cars are self-driving and only 5% have somebody, a human driving them? How are they going to interact and behave with each other? Maybe it's actually better. Maybe they'll, maybe because they're all computers, they'll more easily communicate with each other or somehow, I don't know. But some of those things make me a little, make me wonder a little, like, what are we doing? Like,
will this inspire you for peace?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Just
kind
of ideas.
Yeah. Well, the other one that they keep talking about is that, oh, we've trained these computers to write poetry now. And we've trained these computers, these artificial intelligences, to be composers and compose music. Or they're going to make sculptures. They're going to design their own, you know. So they're like, oh, maybe we won't need artists anymore because the computers will just make the art. And I'm like, I don't think so.
Yeah. You think about in your work about rituals, because lots of the instruments that I used in rituals, I mean, sacred and non-sacred rituals, but let's say rituals what keep the society together. Mm-hmm. I mean, this kind of idea.
Yeah.
In sound is quite often there. Somehow, being a tambourine, being wind instruments, and so on, and I was wondering in the technology.
But I know some people, like for example, I think like Pauline Oliveras, the late Pauline, she used to do these deep listening sessions, and it was all about, I think, being, you know, there was a certain meditative quality to what it was that she was doing, and she was really concerned with that, but in a way that I felt was still kind of abstract and was maybe more about community than about any kind of specific spiritual practice. It wasn't culturally attached to any particular religious practice or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was definitely there was definitely kind of like a meditation side in a way to her way of working and thinking. And I really respected that, and I really respect a lot of the people who've been influenced by her and what they've come up with. And that those pieces are, I mean, it almost reminds me of like the Yoko Ono, what do they call the imagine pieces, the think pieces, where she's like, basically the whole piece is a little instruction that says, you know, imagine a bell, you know, ringing 20 feet above your head. Now imagine this, and then that's the piece, you know? But, you know, so there's like people whose work is working in ways that are kind of like maybe working somehow with the human spirit or thought process in some way that is ritualistic, maybe. But I've never thought of, I actually did have a collaboration once with some people who were more in that sort of ritual. It's particularly this one woman, really wonderful Buto dancer who I was collaborating with for many years. She was kind of into this sort of ritual-y kind of thing, but I've never really, in my practice, I've never really thought concretely about ritual.
Well, it has to do somehow also with perception. I mean, let's say singing in the in the 20th century, it was made in a specific building, or even before, even way before. And so there is this idea of ritual, without necessarily all the magical and all this thing, but how a voice, in this case, can trigger. Like theater,
Definitely
the imaginary that it creates. You know,
yeah, I mean, I'm definitely aware of the fact that the human voice does have a particular effect on humans, and I'm not. I certainly don't think you can fight that. That's just it's built in, you know. And I think it adds an interesting layer. And I also know that, for example, you can do things. I think, in a way, the human voice is sort of similar to the human face. It's like in visual art, as soon as there's a face that's recognizable as a face, it really changes the piece. People are drawn to something that looks like eyes that are looking at them, you know, or that looks like eyes, nose, and a mouth. People see that and immediately. And the other thing is people are very sensitive to what you do to that. So you can have a very abstract image and you can stretch it and pull it and do different things to it, and it's not really going to affect people one way or the other. You could even have plants like a tree, and you can stretch the tree and make an elongated tree or a you know, distorted tree form. People will not get particularly affected one way or the other, but as soon as you put a human form or a face in there and you start stretching or elongating or doing something like that, it has an emotional impact on people, because I think they identify themselves as being in there, you know. And I think the same is true of music. As soon as there's a human voice in music, people hear it differently than they would if there wasn't a human voice there. And so I think that's just a very powerful ingredient.
Yeah, kind of definition of what the space of technology has there, and what maybe is not ritual, maybe it's just instrument, it's just, you know, and
Well, my relationship with the technology too is that of that I think of it as my instrument, and I have no more or no less reverence for that than I do for other kinds of instruments. And I'm always telling people, you know, they always say, oh, technology this, technology that, and I'm like, you know, a concert grand piano, that's about as sophisticated a piece of technology as you can imagine. And it's been around for a long time, not forever. And I'm sure that when they were new, all of the clavichord people were like, ooh, that new technology, I don't know.
Probably.
You know, it's like, oh, it's loud and soft, you know, or whatever. But still, it's just... that what's involved in learning to play that instrument and really effectively interface as this human body with this mechanical device that's incredibly sophisticated and very, very well designed, so that when you touch those keys, very different ways of touching them has very different results, you know? And that's technology, you know? And so a person like a pianist who's like a really, really high level, high caliber pianist, that person in a weird way is a technologist, because they've mastered a very kind of sophisticated thing. And I think a lot of acoustic musical instruments that have no electronics in them at all have that same, you know, attribute, that they're really pinnacles of human creation, you know. And so when I'm working with all this other stuff, and it's frustrating too, because there's a whole new set of things, like your piano is never going to crash. Like, it's never going to, the system of the piano operating system is never going to get corrupted. You know, it's like, it may go out of tune, and you may get, if somebody doesn't take care of the instrument, the wood might warp, or the soundboard may pull away from the thing, you know, but the piano is not going to, like, not start up one day in front of, you know, audience is about to come in and, oh no, I can't start the piano. So there's really new issues that come with using all of this technology, that it's, you know, you can't pretend that it's, oh, it's exactly the same. I'm not trying to say that, but what I'm saying is, just in terms of my relationship to it and how I use it and how it, what part of what it is in my work is, it represents that it's my instrument. I think of my instrument as being the combination of my voice and these devices that I use. And it's interesting how the instrument that I, for performance, my main instrument, like the core of what I'm doing on stage as a performer, is usually using my voice in combination now with a max patch that has all of my delay lines and other processing things pulling in through there, and then some controllers that allow me to control what's happening with that. And it's all those things working in concert together that I think of as my instrument. Like, my instrument is not just the electronics, and it's not just my voice. If people say, oh, what does she do? Oh, she's a singer. That's kind of not adequate to explain what it is that I do, but it's also not adequate to say Pamela Z, electronics. You know, it's the combination of my voice and those electronics that really is the instrument that I'm playing. And so, regardless of all of the other little details about, like, how that's different from playing the piano or playing a viola or whatever, it's still my instrument, and it's still, I think that the impact it has on the kinds of things I create is kind of similar to the impact that other instruments have on whatever people who are playing them create, you know, because of whatever its possibilities are and whatever its quirks are and whatever, like, the kinds of mistakes that are likely to happen when you do something wrong, that those happy accidents that you find something really interesting that you would have never found on your own, but you were trying to do one thing and it didn't work and the other thing that happened was actually more interesting than what you were trying to do in the first place. That kind of stuff, I'm sure, also happens for people playing acoustic instruments as they're learning to play with them or experimenting with different things they can do with them, you know, discovering that, oh, you know, I'm sure that, like, when somebody first discovered that you could touch a string really lightly and get the harmonics, that probably was not, I bet you that was something that happened by accident. I bet that wasn't, like, you know, the first person who invented a stringed instrument with strings that are, you know, under tension and therefore vibrating at a certain frequency, that person maybe didn't really think about it right away, that if you touched it very lightly in the center, that you would suddenly have these harmonics. That was probably something that somebody did by act. They were probably reaching around their instrument and they heard ping, and they went, oh, what is that? Oh, I'm gonna use that, you know? So I just think a lot of those happy accidents are possible, whether your instrument is digital or electronic, or whether it's just made out of cat gut and wood or, you know, reeds or whatever it's made out of. So, I mean, I know that's oversimplifying a little, people have all these like shortcuts, like, oh, you don't have to really be a good artist to, if you just have this tool and it'll, you'll be able to make really cool sounds. You won't have to be. But I still think that really the biggest job of the artist might be the discriminating ear. And to like, maybe you find things by accident and by stumbling upon them, but the good artist recognizes them when they find them and then exploits them in their work. Somebody who doesn't necessarily have that great of an ear is, some great thing might go by and it's just like with 20 other things and they don't really make any difference between them. You know, it's just all, oh, these are all cool noises I can make with this, you know, this new app I bought, you know, or whatever.
There's an app for everything.
You know, and I think, you know, the, no matter what the thing is, it's really who's, whether it's in the right hands or not. That's not to try to denigrate people and say, oh, they're not very good artists, and so they'll never make good music. You know, I'm not trying to say that, but I'm just trying to say that the artistry and the person who's operating whatever it is in the end what is making the distinction as to whether or not the work is interesting, you know. So.
Well, thank you very much. I think we will conclude with this beautiful thought. So thank you very much for accepting this interview and to share your time and your ideas and your thoughts.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck for the next projects then.
Thank you. Thanks.